From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
British Marines and sailors are on their way home. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Iran today abruptly announced the release of 14 men and one woman captured in disputed waters a week and a half ago. Britain did not concede they trespassed on Iranian waters. Tony Blair said the release was accomplished without confrontation or negotiation. On To the Point, was there a deal? Or did Iran provide a surprise gift to the British people, as its president claimed? Was the U.S. involved in a swap for Iranians held in Iraq? Also today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi conducts international diplomacy in Syria. Is she undermining President Bush? Or is it time for a breakthrough?
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Iran is releasing 15 British Marines and sailors captured a week and a half ago in disputed waters. On To the Point, was it a gift, as Iran's president claims, or was there a deal? Was there any U.S. involvement? Also today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Syria, despite the objections of President Bush. We'll hear a debate on her mission and on the role of opposition politicians in foreign policy. First is news update. 45 minutes into a press conference, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made a stunning announcement today. Iran will release 15 captured British Marines and sailors. Here's the voice of a translator in Tehran.
I declare that the people of Iran and the government of Iran, in full power, given their legal right to place on trial the military people, to give amnesty and pardon to these 15 people, and I announce their freedom and their return to the people of Britain.
A few hours later, British Prime Minister Tony Blair thanked allies in the region, and he addressed the Iranian people.
To the Iranian people, I would simply say this. We bear you no ill will. On the contrary, we respect Iran as an ancient civilization, as a nation with a proud and dignified history. And the disagreements that we have with your government, we wish to resolve peacefully through dialogue.
Again, Tony Blair in London. Let's go back to Tehran with Delphine Minoui, who reports from there for the French paper Le Figaro. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
When are the prisoners scheduled to be released?
Well, yes, definitely. What we hear now from Tehran is that actually the 15 sailors are going to spend the night at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. First of all, they were scheduled to leave as soon as possible tonight to be able to join their family back home very soon. But now we are hearing they are going to stay, spend the night here. And tomorrow morning, they are going to be able to go to the British Embassy before finally taking their flights back home.
President Ahmadinejad met with them today in a very public way. It looked as if it were televised all over Iran and perhaps beyond that. What did they say to one another?
Actually, yes, this morning, I mean, today, the announcement by Ahmadinejad was, as you pointed out, a real theater play. He was playing kind of a big suspense. All of a sudden, in the middle of his press conference, he first started to congratulate the Iranian military crew, which arrested the British sailors. Then he decorated them for capturing the sailors. And then there was this big dramatic moment, let's say, and then it started smiling and announcing that the British sailors were about to be freed very soon. So it was a very big surprise for everyone, although, of course, we knew that some backstage negotiations were going on these last days.
Well, the president said that this was a gift to the British people. Did it come as a surprise to the people in Iran?
I think everybody was surprised. Everybody knew that some negotiations were going on, but we were not expecting this from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad today. While I was talking with people in the streets, I could feel that there was some kind of sense of relief, though, because, you know, the fear here in the streets of Tehran was to see these crises actually harming the long-term relationship between Iran and the UK, but also harming the relationship with the West, which is already very bad. Iran is going through big tensions coming from the West, especially on its nuclear file. So the fear coming out from Iranians was that Iran would be stuck with a more isolation on the foreign stage.
You said that everybody thought that negotiations were going on. Once again, the president says this was a gift. Does it appear that Iran got anything from Britain as a result of its agreement to release the 15 sailors?
Well, we don't know exactly the main issue. I mean, maybe there were some negotiations, maybe there was a deal behind the stage, but we don't really know more. But definitely, I mean, the last 2 days we were hearing about a lot of negotiations. To give you an example, before yesterday, there was this first breakthrough with Ali Larijani, who is the chief of the Supreme Council for the National Security. He came out on Channel 4 first announcing that there wouldn't be any trial, which was a very nice, very good sign. And then later on, yesterday, actually last night, there was for the first time this direct phone call made between a close advisor of Tony Blair and, again, Ali Larijani. So we were expecting something going on. The fact that Ahmadinejad is coming out and talking about a gift to the British people goes back to the usual rhetoric of Ahmadinejad. This president is known for being very populist, trying to appeal to the people, and so it was somehow a good comeback for him. It was like a big show, let's say.
We're talking with Delphine Minuit, the reporter for the French daily Figaro in Tehran. We will be back to her. We'll go to London as well and hear more about Iran's release of British prisoners on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To The Point. After President Ahmadinejad announced the release of the prisoners, it was a couple of hours before Prime Minister Blair appeared outside No. 10 Downing Street. He described the process this way.
I know their release will come as a profound relief, not just to them, but to their families that have endured such distress and anxiety over these past 12 days. Throughout, we have taken a measured approach, firm but calm, not negotiating, but not confronting either.
Again, Mary Dashefsky is with us, chief editorial writer for the Independent newspaper in London, former diplomatic editor for that paper as well. And Mary Dashefsky, always good to have you on our program.
Yes, very nice to be with you.
Not negotiating and not confronting either. What do you suppose that means?
Well, it's a very interesting formulation because even before Tony Blair spoke, British officials were making a gigantic difference between negotiation on the one hand, which they said they hadn't been engaging in, and dialogue on the other, which they said they had been engaging in. So you can see a distinction between dialogue and confrontation. And I think it's true that both sides, in fact, stepped back from confrontation. But the distinction between dialogue and negotiation suggests that from the British side, they want to emphasize that there were no deals. They keep talking about this, there were no deals. And I think that's a very interesting message that they're trying to put out.
Your paper, as well as others, have suggested that there was a deal, and perhaps even more than one deal, having to do with the release of an Iranian diplomat who has been detained in Iraq, and the opportunity for Iranians to meet with five other Iranians also detained in Iraq. What more can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, certainly we saw the release of the Iranian diplomat who'd been captive in Iraq, apparently, for the past 2 months, just the day before the release of the British captives was announced. We did see the possibility of a connection there. It almost looked as though, as it were, the one release had been put down down on account that the British captives would then be released, and then maybe, you know, we'll keep watch and see whether there's any progress. There's both the five supposed members of the Iran Revolutionary Guard who were captured by, it is said, American forces in January in Erbil in Iraq. And there's also the Iranians say, anyway, an Iranian general who disappeared in mysterious circumstances, also believed kidnapped in Iraq.
So obviously there are a lot of people in play here, and very little is known about what went on directly. In the meantime, what has been the reaction in Britain itself? Were people thrilled and delighted? Are they concerned about the apparent confessions of the sailors and Marines? How would you describe the atmosphere in London and surrounding?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I was at a gathering this morning where one of the American reporters in London asked why there weren't huge British demonstrations and gigantic protests on behalf of the British captives in Iran. And I think one response to that is that the, as it were, the anti-war feeling in Britain, the anti-Iraq war feeling in Britain, meant that there was, not that there wasn't support on a humanitarian angle for these 15, but there was a feeling that the reason they were there was distinctly suspect, and there wasn't particular popular support for the fact that they were actually in Iraqi waters and patrolling there. So that was the first thing. Second thing is, I think there was a sort of air of calm about all this, which suggested that at least for the time being, it wasn't going to get any worse. There was almost a sort of confidence there, especially when the Iranians put out a video which showed them sitting around with food, looking reasonably relaxed, wearing their uniforms. This was completely different from the video that had been put out 3 years ago when there were also British servicemen captured, and they were shown, they were paraded, they were blindfolded, they were bound, they were in clothes that the Iranians had put them in. They were very much under duress. And I think that the popular feeling here was that the video sent a rather different message this time around. Although this wasn't how the authorities saw it, British officials said it was completely unacceptable, that the hostages were being paraded, that the confessions had been extracted under duress, etc., etc. But I think there was always the feeling that negotiations were going on under the surface, and until those broke down, it was worth, as it were, hanging on and being patient on the part of the public as well.
Mary Dushevsky, chief editorial writer of The Independent in London. Let's go back to Tehran with Delphine Minoui with Le Figaro. What about the contention by many people that the confessions, the statements by the British Marines who said that they were, in fact, in Iranian waters and apologized for that on television. Is there any evidence at all as to whether or not they were coerced?
Well, definitely there is still no evidence at all. You know, the Persian Gulf and this line, this border going through the Persian Gulf is very sensitive. And in the past, it was already a reason for problems between Iran and Iraq, but also 2 years ago, we remember that some British soldiers were already arrested at the Shatt al-Arab, which is the river then going through the Persian Gulf. So Iran, I mean, my feeling is that if we try to understand now the Iranian position, we can say that during this whole crisis, Iran felt kind of victimized. It blamed the British sailors for entering its waters at a time, again, when Iran is under a huge pressure from the West. So, you know, there is actually a lot of paranoia going on in Tehran these days. So somehow, by arresting and then holding these sailors, the Islamic Republic was definitely trying to give some kind of a demonstration of strength to the West.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. Again, Delphine Minoui is with Le Figaro in Tehran. We'll go back to Mary Dushevsky in London in a moment. First, though, there's this. Yesterday, President Bush was asked if the U.S. would give up those five Iranians we were talking about a moment ago, now being held in Iraq. Here's his answer.
I said the other day that, first of all, the seizure of the sailors is indefensible by the Iranians, and that I support the Blair government's attempts to solve this issue peacefully. So we're in close consultation with the British government. I also strongly support the Prime Minister's declaration that there should be no quid pro quos when it comes to the hostages.
Again, President Bush speaking yesterday. Daphne Linzer is national security correspondent for The Washington Post, formerly diplomatic correspondent for that paper. And Daphne Linzer, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Warren.
Not exactly a direct answer to the question. Would you, in fact, have a trade? He did say that he didn't think that the Brits should engage in a quid pro quo.
That's right. He dodged, which is really interesting, especially in light of some of the revelations in the British press about whether or not there's going to be some kind of deal here that is going to include access to Iranians that are being held by U.S. troops, we believe, although it is unclear who is holding these Iranians exactly inside Iraq. So that's a big question. And as you said, you know, it's interesting that the president chose not to respond to that.
Now, these five Iranians are the ones we heard about a moment ago from Mary Dushevsky, picked up in Erbil in the Kurdish part of the country. And at the time, the Kurds were outraged. They said that they were diplomats.
That's right, and that's been a big, you know, a big issue here. You know, the Kurds have gotten a lot quieter, you know, about that in recent weeks. But the but their feelings, you know, are on the record, and they certainly haven't disavowed them. And that is, you know, the Kurds have strong relations with the Iranians. They don't want to see Iraq become a battlefield between the United States and Iran. And you know, they believe that those people were under their protection and had a right to be there. And the fact that they remain incarcerated and without any kind of you know, judicial procedure here is certainly a source of tension now between the Kurds and the U.S. government.
Mary Dushevsky, back to you in London. Tony Blair today thanked everybody under the sun, the allies in the Middle East, the U.N. Security Council, and several others, but rather pointedly, it would seem, did not say anything at all about the United States.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I thought it was a glaring omission when I watched him and listened to him speaking live from Downing Street. There was, I think, some feeling here in official circles that President Bush had actually made matters worse when quite early in the crisis he referred to the British sailors as hostages. Now, that raised all sorts of echoes in Britain with the American hostage crisis, also with the British sailors who were captured 3 years ago and were actually let out quite relatively quickly. But the use of that word hostages was described, of course, always off the record as being unhelpful. And certainly, I think the Iranian officials were even more negative about it, saying that that hadn't helped. But I think that opinion was also shared in London.
Daphne Linzer, back to you. President Bush, though, yesterday said there had been close consultation between his administration and the Blair administration. How do you suppose they feel now about being left out of the thank yous?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, obviously, you know, the U.S. government felt that it was the right thing to do to take a back seat at the beginning, said almost nothing, and then sort of, you know, right at the moment where it's clear that things are moving pretty rapidly, you know, between London and Tehran, the president comes out, you know, and makes a pretty forceful statement about it. You know, now we'll wait and see. I mean, we don't know exactly, you know, what transpired here between the Blair government and the Bush administration, what exactly London wanted from Washington here, and again, you know, whether or not this is going to include some kind of access to the Iranians that are being held inside Iraq.
In the meantime, we're going to talk a little bit later on our program about Nancy Pelosi and her visit to Damascus and the meeting with the president of Syria. But in the meantime, officials in Syria are claiming that Damascus, in fact, played a key role in getting the 15 British sailors and Marines, the 14 men and one woman, of course, released by Iran. Hassan Fatah is Middle East correspondent for The New York Times, and he's in Damascus. And thanks, as always, to you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What can you tell us about what the Syrians are saying about their role in all this?
Well, in a relatively surprise announcement, just moments after Nancy Pelosi left Damascus, in fact, within the airport terminal itself, Syria's foreign minister announced that, in fact, they had been heavily involved in the negotiation between Iran and the United Kingdom. They didn't provide much detail, but it somehow makes a lot of sense that Syria, which has probably the closest relations with Iran today of any Arab country, would get involved. It certainly also helps improve the image of Syria, which has been desperately trying to, number one, improve its image and break the lock that the U.S. administration has put on it.
Mary Duszewski, back to you in London. Does it make sense from London's point of view that Syria would have been involved in this?
Yes, it does, partly because Britain was trying to court Syria before the Iraq War, and they've kept channels open ever since, even if it hasn't always looked that way. Also, there was this big disagreement, really, between the Bush administration and the Blair government about the what we call the Baker Report and what to do with about Iraq. And the particular point of disagreement was whether to talk to Syria and Iran or whether not to. And that was a particular point that we felt that President Bush had dismissed. Now, the crisis with Iran, between Britain and Iran, looked as though it threatened to shut the door between Britain and Iran that I think the British certainly wanted to keep open, and now it appears Iran does too. So it makes perfect sense that Syria, which also had an interest both in keeping the door to Britain open, but also in keeping communications open, three-way communications between Iran, Syria, Britain, with a view to what's going on in Iraq. So, yes, it makes perfect sense.
Daphne Linzer, back to you at The Washington Post. The British administration, Bush administration, already very unhappy, of course, about Nancy Pelosi's visit. If, in fact, Syria was involved in this, how do you suppose Washington would respond to that?
That's such a good question. I think they've been really, really vocal in their sort of displeasure with Pelosi's trip to Damascus, and certainly, you know, if Damascus was, you know, involved and helpful in this, then you know, that's certainly going to look pretty uncomfortable for the Bush administration. You know, I think timing here, as we see now, may have been, you know, one of the big factors for their displeasure on Pelosi's trip. You know, the timing may be the issue here, and of course, you know, if she can confirm that in fact they were helpful on this, and they were involved in this, then, you know, it'll be very difficult for the administration to continue to say, you know, how difficult the Syrians are being and how unhelpful they're being on every issue, especially if, you know, their closest ally, Tony Blair, you know, is also finding that the Syrians were helpful.
Well, thank you all very much. As I said, we're going to talk in the next half hour about Nancy Pelosi's visit. Thanks to Daphne Linzer at The Washington Post, Mary Duszewski at The Independent in London for being with us. Hassan Fatah will stay with us. We'll talk more with him, a correspondent in the New York Times, for The New York Times, is in Damascus at the moment. We'll be right back with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. As we just heard, despite President Bush's objections, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi met today in Damascus with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Pelosi told reporters she expressed concern to him about Syria's support of Hamas and Hezbollah. She also carried the message from Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert that he is ready for peace talks.
Peace in the Middle East is a high priority for the American people and indeed the people in this region and in the world. We were very pleased with the reassurances we received from the president that he was ready to resume the peace process. He was ready to engage in negotiations with peace with Israel.
Again, Nancy Pelosi leaving Damascus. The Syrian cabinet minister, Botena Shaaban, described the meeting this way.
She sent the right message to Arab people, to people in the Middle East, that this is how United States statesmen or women should be, should come here and find out what the reality is and talk. And this is certainly the way to solve problems rather than to launch wars.
Once again, Hassan Fatah is with us, Middle East correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Damascus. Is the Syrian government calling this a victory of a kind?
Well, in many ways, it is a victory. You had the third most powerful person in the United States show up at their doorstep. And it's amidst a time of great crisis and difficulty. And in many ways, they've sought to emphasize, use this to emphasize that they are no longer going to be isolated as the Bush administration would like them to be.
Was there anything in Ms. Pelosi's news conference that reflected what we talked about earlier, the possible Syrian involvement with resolving the crisis over the captured British Marines and sailors?
Well, certainly Ms. Pelosi and the rest of the delegation emphasized Syria's important role in helping in peace, especially in Lebanon, certainly in Iraq, as well as perhaps in Israel and Palestine. But certainly that announcement was a surprise.
We saw a lot of pictures yesterday of Speaker Pelosi going around Damascus and visiting with people, visiting a mosque and so on. Were there any pictures of her with the president, Mr. al-Assad?
There were pictures of her this morning with the Mr. Assad. The meeting actually didn't happen until today. Yesterday, she had a dinner with various opposition members and members of Syria's parliament, a relatively large group of people from various walks of life in Syria, in which she had discussions and listened to a lot of what they had to say.
Does the opposition in Syria speak with a loud voice? Is it at all threatening to the president that, as you pointed out, the third most powerful person in the United States would meet with his opposition?
Well, while it was important that some opposition members showed up, in fact, the Syrian opposition has long suffered from being disjointed and having divergent interests and goals. But at the same time, the regime here has increasingly cracked down on opposition members. Several of them are on trial, and some have been imprisoned.
Ms. Pelosi indicated that she had said something to the president about Hamas and Hezbollah, expressed a concern about his support for those organizations, called by the United States, of course, terrorist groups. Was anything said by the Syrians afterward about that?
Well, they sought to defend themselves in the support, emphasizing that, they differed on some areas and that it's okay to differ, but that the debate and the dialogue is the most important part.
Well, Hassan Fatah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Middle East correspondent for The New York Times in Damascus. Next door in Lebanon, this meeting, which the Syrians once again are calling a victory, and so is Hassan Fatah of The New York Times, is being watched very, very closely. Michael Young is opinion editor for the English-language Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. And Michael Young, thanks as always to you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's your take on the visit by Ms. Pelosi, once again, the third in line to be president of the United States, to a leader that, or with a leader that the president of the United States wants to shun?
Well, I mean, I think that Mrs. Pelosi was on a fool's errand in Damascus. She'll not get anything out of the Syrians. I think there are three things that I noticed in this. First of all, she basically went to Damascus for domestic American reasons. And in the process, she basically trashed the foreign policies towards Syria of the U.S., the European Union, and the Arab states, who have all been trying in the last weeks and months to try to prevent and stop Syrian meddling in Lebanon, and to essentially unblock the situation in Lebanon. The Syrians have been blocking it. Ms. Pelosi, by opening towards Damascus, essentially showed that either she didn't have a clue what was going on around her or that she was consciously trying to trash this foreign policy. Second problem, I think, is that it seems that Mrs. Pelosi didn't bother to read the latest UN report on Rafiq Hariri's assassination, which all but confirmed that Syrians were involved in the assassination of the former Lebanese prime minister. Now, as you may know, today we're in the process of trying to form a mixed Lebanese international tribunal to try the suspects in that crime. The Syrians have been blocking that for months. So really, when Mrs. Pelosi goes to Damascus and walks around Damascus's souks as if nothing were happening, it seems that she seems to have completely forgotten the fact that there's a political murder that is now being investigated by the United Nations, a first, and this doesn't really matter to her, it seems. Third issue that I found quite surprising is that, you know, the fact of the matter is the Syrians have used this access to Iraq of the Mujahideen, of Islamists, of Salafists, to attack the United States as a means of pressure on the United States. And certainly quite a few have been responsible for the death of American soldiers. I really don't understand what kind of message she's sending when she goes to Damascus, when she walks around Damascus as if she were in any normal capital in the world. A very friendly visit by the speaker. What kind of message does that send to the families of Americans whose sons have been killed in Iraq?
Michael Young, opinion editor for the Daily Star in Beirut. Joshua Landis is assistant professor of history, co-director of peace studies at the University of Oklahoma. He's also an expert on Syria, runs the blog SyriaComment.com. Joshua Landis, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What do you hear, or what do you say, rather, to what we just heard from Michael Young, that this was a fool's errand?
Well, I don't think it's a fool's errand, and I think that Pelosi is reading the the indications of where things are going in the Middle East pretty well. It's very important for the Democrats and for the United States to begin to carve out a policy that makes sense in the Middle East. And we just had, you know, talking to the Syrians is key. The Syrians are sitting geographically in the middle of the Middle East. They have great influence on the Iranians, Arab-Israeli conflict, Lebanon, and on Iraq. And all of those are key issues to the United States. We have sought, under the Bush administration, to bring Syria to its knees through economic sanctions and many other means and trying to isolate it. This has failed. And the fact that it's failing has not been ignored by regional actors. Saudi Arabia just got through holding an Arab League summit in which Syria was given a prominent role. And Saudi Arabia is moved away from the United States. The head of the EU foreign policy, Solana, came to Syria last week. Merkel, the Germans are coming. Other people have gone to Syria. All of them are worried that Bush is failing, that this policy is going to fail, and they're looking for other ways to move ahead. And Bashar al-Assad has said very clearly, we're important. We want a deal. We can work on all these issues with you. And as you mentioned in the beginning of the program, Syria was involved in trying to ease the release of British captives in Iran. Syria also played a prominent role in trying to bring together the Hamas and the PLO for this coalition government that was formed. And all the sides thanked Syria before it was announced in Saudi Arabia. So Syria is trying to indicate, we can play ball with you, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's by helping with Iran, and we're willing to negotiate. We're willing to distance ourselves from Iran and play down support for Hezbollah, Hamas, and so forth, but we need to go on heights back. This has been occupied by Israel since 67, and we want to get it back. We're not against the United States, but so long as the United States is trying to constrain us and to bring us to our knees, we're not going to help it, and we're going to hurt it.
Let me bring two other voices into this conversation. First, Brian Darling, who is congressional analyst for the Conservative Heritage Foundation. And Mr. Darling, good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
What's your response to what we're hearing from Joshua Landis? This was not a fool's errand. It's time to get a policy that makes sense and that recognizing Syria's deep involvement in so many of the crises that we're involved in is a good idea.
Well, it's very important to step back a second and understand that Speaker Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House, not the Secretary of State. We have a president. His name is George Bush. And it's inappropriate for Congress to get involved in these decisions. Congress has overstepped its authority in this matter. It's also overstepped its authority in trying to tie the hands of the president on how to fight the war in Iraq, on trying to make the president start withdrawing troops within 120 days and have a full withdrawal from March of next year. You look at what's going on there, we need to speak with one voice as a nation, and that voice should come from the President of the United States, not a member of Congress.
Back to the question of Syria, though. Three Republican leaders met with President Assad over the weekend, and there was at least one Republican with Speaker Pelosi as well. You don't object to them?
As the president has said, it's inappropriate for any member of Congress to go over there in a diplomatic mission. If these are fact-finding missions, that's one thing that's completely appropriate. But if members of Congress are going over and trying to engage in diplomacy, that's the realm of our Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, and members of Congress should not be negotiating with Syria, which is a nation that is a state sponsor of terrorism, and is there is evidence that they are providing material support for elements in Iraq that are fighting our men and women today.
Brian Darling with the Heritage Foundation. I said two more voices, and let me introduce the final one on this part of our program. Charles Kupchan, who's former National Security Council staff member of, during the first Clinton administration, now director of Europe Studies and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, also professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. And Charles Kupchan, good to have you with us.
Glad to join you.
Your response to Brian Darling. The Speaker of the House is not the Secretary of State. It's the President's business. We ought to speak with one voice.
Well, I'd make two points in response. One is that I don't think that this trip and that Pelosi's visit to Syria is as extraordinary as it's being treated, in the sense that there are plenty of congressional delegations to Syria, including, as you mentioned, Warren, Republicans visiting over the weekend. And some are fact-finding, some are shading into the diplomatic area. You had Bob Dole going to Yugoslavia during the Clinton era. You've had many other people take trips that to some extent have a diplomatic cast to them. This particular trip between Pelosi and Assad, I think, is getting so much attention because it is part of a growing confrontation between the Democrats and the Republicans, between the Congress and the Republican-controlled White House. And in that sense, it's a part of this bigger puzzle. And secondly, the Bush administration has had 6 years to pursue a policy of forcibly bringing democracy to the Middle East, of isolating rogue regimes like Syria and Iran in North Korea, and it hasn't worked. Iraq is a disaster. In the one case, North Korea, the Bush administration has finally engaged and used diplomacy to get a deal. And the American people, I think, in the November 2006 election spoke out clearly and said, we want to change. This Bush doctrine isn't working. So it seems to me that it is not only acceptable for the Democrats to try to push back on Iraq, on Syria, on other issues, but it is their responsibility, in light of the election and the public attitudes of the American people toward Bush's foreign policy.
Charles Kupchan at the Council on Foreign Relations. Let me go back to Michael Young in Beirut. You began this conversation by saying that you thought the speaker was acting for domestic reasons, and certainly those who support what she's doing would seem to confirm that. They're saying that the American policy has failed in the Middle East. What about that? You said that the policy has been trashed, but has the policy been successful from anybody's point of view?
Well, yes, it's been. I mean, you know, it's been successful in some respects and unsuccessful in others. On Lebanon, and I mean, let me be very honest here. The fact that the Professor Landis was suggesting that the Arabs are unhappy—that's incorrect. In fact, in recent weeks, and indeed at the Arab League summit, the Arabs have offered Syria a way out. They said, "Look, you must. It must be hands off Lebanon. You must accept the Hariri Tribunal, and we will allow you back into the family of the Arab family. And if you've got to stop supporting Hamas, you've got to distance yourself from Iran." So the fact of the matter is the Bush administration is not as isolated on Syria as some would say. The fact is that on Syria, there has been a consensus between Europe, between the Arab world, the main Arab states, and the Bush administration. The fact is that there has been a consensus to cease to prevent Syrian meddling in Lebanon. The Syrians have been blocking, as I said, the political process for months. They've been trying to block the tribunal. And let me focus on that. That has been successful. For the first time, you have an international tribunal mandated by the Security Council that is trying to punish a political crime. The last report by the UN investigators into that, all that accuse Syria of being responsible for that crime. You can read the report. It's very clear. They don't mention Syria specifically, but they do everything but mention it specifically. Now, for once, you have a process, an international process, that is moving forward. The Syrians are clearly trying to block it for reasons that we can imagine, because it may very well threaten their regime. I think that the international community should for once look at the advantages, look at that as a successful process to essentially bring a regime to essentially hold the regime accountable legally. So I don't agree that it's all been a failure. Lebanon has been a remarkable success, and when Pelosi goes to Damascus and essentially says that the road to solving Lebanon's problem passes through Damascus, that's exactly the wrong message that has been sent by the UN Security Council and by the Arab states in the last many months. They've all been trying to say, no, Damascus must essentially get its hands off of Lebanon, must stop supporting Hezbollah, must stop arming Hezbollah, must stop blocking the political process. If the consensus begins to break down, as it has, as it began to break down today with Pelosi, and even earlier than that, I would say Pelosi was really a big breakdown in the consensus, then obviously I think that a rare success in this part of the world is threatened with disintegration.
Let me go back to Joshua Landis on that, assistant professor once again at the University of Oklahoma. What do you say to that? And wouldn't it be a loss if, in fact, the tribunal weren't able to occur and the pressures on Syria in that regard were eased up?
Well, first of all, you know, the Lebanese would like to have American policy on hold until the Lebanese situation is solved. America can't do that. It would be unwise to do that. And secondly, this, you know, it's been for 2 years this investigation has been going on. It's been inconclusive. The Lebanese are completely divided down the middle. And, you know, the whole world can stop and wait for the Lebanese to sort out their problems. And there's no doubt that Syria is playing a role in that. But it's not just Syria. The Shiites are in the opposition. Many of the Christians are in opposition, following Aoun, and many Sunnis are as well. And they want a bigger voice in government. This is a Lebanese problem. It's an extension of the civil war that went on from 79 to 90. And Syria is playing a role. But if America tries to hold its foreign policy, its negotiations on things like Iraq, on peace with Israel, on influence of Iran, in abeyance until this, you know, until Lebanon solves its problems, we could be here for many more years. And there's no indication that that American policy, which has been to try to force Syria to completely leave to disband its influence in Lebanon, has been a successful so far. And this is another Syrian foot in the door, and we have to figure out a way to come to accommodation.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and talk more about the appropriateness of having the Speaker of the House of Representatives engaged in international diplomacy on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Mormon Olney back with To the Point, talking once again about Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Syria. Back to Charles Kupchan, the former National Security Council staff during the Clinton administration. Again, back to Brian Darling's point that it's simply inappropriate for somebody in the Congress to take on this kind of a role. When you were in the National Security Council staff and at other times during the history of the United States, how often has an opposition leader such as Nancy Pelosi, despite the fact you say that there's a growing confrontation, but how often have they seized the moment to get involved in such a deep way in diplomacy overseas in a way that that's really contrary to what the president's doing?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's not in any way unique in terms of congressional delegations, including high-level delegations.
Speaker of the House?
I can't remember a case of a Speaker of the House going. On the other hand, these are extraordinary times. This is a situation in which there is a political crisis, and one could even say a constitutional crisis over the conduct of foreign policy, and that's one of the reasons that the Democrats are trying to assert themselves. And I also think it's important to keep in mind what Pelosi was doing. If, for example, she had tried to cut a particular deal on the Middle East peace process or the situation in Lebanon or on Iraq, that would be one thing. She did nothing of the sort. She was basically trying to open up a dialogue, to have a conversation with America's enemies in the way that the Bush administration refuses to do. And it seems to me that there's no harm done in that. Does it necessarily lead to some sort of positive outcome? No. But will it perhaps move the ball forward on the Mideast peace process? Might Syria now be more cooperative on trying to stop insurgents from going across the border into Iraq? Perhaps. So I think that one has to put Pelosi's trip in the context of a democratic view that the Bush administration's approach isn't working and that an alternative course is needed, and the Democrats are the ones that have to provide it.
Brian Darling, back to you with the Heritage Foundation. Is there something important about the fact that Ms. Pelosi holds the office that she does? Is this somehow fundamentally different from having the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee or somebody like that going overseas?
Yeah, the fact that we're talking about the Speaker of the House makes it, raises it to another level, and obviously this mission is being watched by the whole world. And we have to step back and remember that the Speaker of the House does not assign ambassadors to go to different nations. The Speaker of the House is not the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. When you talk about diplomacy, you have carrots and sticks. You have good things and bad things. And the threat of military force is behind any negotiations from the president, and Speaker Pelosi doesn't have the power to do that. So when we're talking about Speaker Pelosi engaging in this mission, it's inappropriate. It sends a mixed message to the Mideast. We as the United States need to be speaking through one voice, and that voice is President George Bush.
Mr. Kupchan, how would you and others in the Clinton administration have felt if Newt Gingrich during the 90s, let's say after the election of 1994, going about meeting with foreign leaders and in a way that directly challenged the Clinton administration?
Well, I think that there's no question that this type of trip is going to create some ill will on the part of the Bush administration, in the same way that when Bob Dole engaged in negotiations with the Albanians and tried to get attention on the situation in Kosovo, the Clinton administration felt that Dole was sort of going through the back door and doing an end run. That's inevitable. But as I said, I think the question is that this takes place at a time in which there is a sense of crisis in the conduct of American foreign policy. The Bush administration seems to have lost public confidence on this issue, one of the main reasons the Democrats won the midterms. And in this sense, it behooves the Democrats to try to impose upon the president a different course of action. And keep in mind that what Pelosi is doing is in many respects picking up on the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group, which the Bush administration, in fact, wanted to have, and that bipartisan set of recommendations included a clear call to engage both Iran and Syria.
Brian Darling, quickly, did Senator Dole violate the kinds of principles that you've enunciated when he got involved in the Balkans?
Well, any member of Congress that would go overseas to negotiate diplomatically would be an inappropriate trip. And if Senator Dole did that, then it was inappropriate. If he was there in a fact-finding mission, that's far different. But as to the Iraq Study Group, I don't believe the Iraq Study Group recommended that the Speaker of the House engage in diplomacy and speak with Iran and Syria. So any suggestion that members of Congress take the place of the president, engage in these types of negotiations when members of Congress don't have any power to negotiate is wrong, and that's a misinterpretation of what the Iraq Study Group recommended.
Michael Young, back to you. You went into detail about all of the issues that are pending with regard to Syria and other countries in the Middle East, particularly Lebanon. What about the point that Ms. Pelosi didn't cut any deals? She wasn't there to on that kind of a mission at all, simply trying to open up a channel.
Yeah, but I mean, that doesn't mean anything. She opened up a channel, but what she did, of course, is that she showed that there was a deep division in the United States on foreign policy, and I think she did it in the wrong place. Of course, we can discuss Iraq, for example, but the fact of the matter is, and I really want to stress this, it's incorrect to say that the Bush administration has lost that there's been a loss of confidence at all levels in the Bush administration. The fact of the matter is the Bush administration in Lebanon and on quite a few other issues outside of Iraq continues to work within an Arab consensus. The fact of the matter is, as I said, the tribunal is a main issue, the Hariri tribunal.
Okay.
And, you know, that's important. The fact that Pelosi did not take that into consideration, I think, is the Syrians will exploit this.
Joshua Landis, just a moment left, and I'm sorry to have interrupted Michael Young, but do we want countries around the world to know how divided we are? Is that a sign of weakness? Should we, in fact, try to restore the old principle that our debates stop at the water's edge?
I think it's a sign of strength. I mean, America's a democracy, and at times democracies have to debate these things. And Pelosi, 70% of Americans say they're in favor of dialogue with Syria and Iran. And Pelosi has to begin to carve out a new policy. She didn't give anything away on Lebanon. She said starkly that she understood the situation in Lebanon and she was not going to Syria to give away anything on Lebanon. So I don't think, you know, I think she's doing what we expect of a democratic leader to do, which is to look after the interests. And I think that Middle Easterners will sigh with relief, not because they think America's weak, but because they think America's strong and it's able to change course when something fails.
All right. Joshua Landis again at the University of Oklahoma, his blog, SyriaComment.com. Michael Young with the Daily Star in newspaper, not sighing with relief. Charles Kupchan with the National Security Council in the Clinton administration, now at the Council on Foreign Relations and Georgetown University, and Brian Darling at the Heritage Foundation. Good to have all of you with us. Today's program produced by Dan Konecki with Katie Cooper and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica at Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.